Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy. Kia ora koutou. Kia ora Dave. How are you?
Kia ora. Very well. Thank you very much. And compliments of the rapidly advancing new year to you.
tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
I'm a general practitioner, vocationally registered, many years in general practice, but work predominantly these days, I guess you could say in quality, but it's looking at medical complaints via Health and Disability Commission, also a bit of governance work, and leading a peer group with my local medical centre.
And you help to keep me and everybody else on track with some of the latest and greatest news from the sector. So in our January clinical snippets, January 2023, a new year.
It is, and I got the date right, which is quite unusual for this time of the year. but I thought it's a fairly gentle introduction into 2023, just a bit of stuff I've been reading over the holiday period.
Well, thank you for that. I know I'm grateful. I'm a bit slow this year so far.
I try and just make things a little easier for my colleagues by if I can identify resources that might be handy or new hints and things to try and pass those on. But start off with an area that we see a lot of in general practice, which is insomnia and other sleep conditions. Mm-hmm. A recent Goodfellow gem included a very straightforward screening tool for common sleep conditions, so that when somebody turns up saying they don't sleep, you could use, if you wanted to use this questionnaire, which is double-sided A4, and it just, I guess, as a reminder, but also helps you to determine what factors might be relevant in the patient's sleep disorder. So it covers things like possible depression, possible alcohol use disorder, sleep, things like shift work might be interfering, drug taking, etc. So just very straightforward, handy, quick to do, and could raise issues which you might not have covered before you hand out the sopiclone prescription otherwise.
Nice.
But in fact, the article also looked at two, what they call them, lesser known issues. I'm not sure that I agree that they're lesser known sleep disorders, but the first one was primary insomnia or chronic insomnia, when patients spend more time in bed than they need to. And the second one was delayed sleep phase disorder, which is essentially a teenage sleep pattern seen in about 25% of university students, where these people prefer to go to bed late at night, usually after midnight, and get up very late the following morning. And for that group, they need melatonin at night and light boxes or sunlight early in the morning as an easing measure. But the Australian Sleep Association website I looked at, and it's actually extremely helpful. So it's got a huge number of resources on various sleep disorders, including questionnaires, assessment prompts, patient information leaflets. And one that you might find quite helpful is quite a detailed account on undertaking brief behavioral therapy for insomnia. Yeah. So it goes through the whole phases, how to actually do this with your patient in quite some detail, including information for the patient. And just might be something you could add to your armamentarium if you're not doing it already, in terms of dealing with patients with sleep disorders.
Any idea how brief is brief?
I think it's over several sessions, so right. It's not just an appointment, but so it involves educating the patient and giving them information to start with, so they understand about the normal sleep cycle, etc., and then the various, I think it's over three appointments, the various interventions that you do with the patient around. That's relaxation great. Therapy, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of it's become a subspecialty, hasn't it? The because the and I always worry that those things are just being made more complicated than they need to be. And in the real world, people don't have time to go and see specialists around this sort of thing. And it should be something that we should be able to help with this without using medication if we, you know, in an ideally.
That's yeah, absolutely. I think this just gives you a few more tools to stay away from the easy option, the easiest option, which is reach for the pen, and often the option that the patients come in expecting or asking for. So I think dealing with patient expectations, if you've got something that you can give them that will help educate them, etc., that's a huge advantage.
Yeah, I like the frameworks and the questionnaires as well because they make sure, you know, I'm pretty confident that I would ask the right questions, but having a questionnaire like that, the short sleeps questionnaire there, means that you do cover all of the things that you need to. You know, you're not missing something, and you can get the patient to give them a pen, give them the form. You know, here you go, fill this out for me, and then they don't have the they can do that honestly without feeling the pressure of, you know, oh, what does he want to hear?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's handy if it's, you know, if the insomnia is the while I'm here, doctor, or as I'm going out the door, it's something that you can get them to take away and then bring back to discuss once they've filled it in. So
And the website looks like something I can read tonight, sort of between 10 and midnight when I'm sort of
yes,
struggling to get to sleep.
I think it will probably put you to sleep. It might.
Yeah.
And interestingly, just along those lines, I get a reasonable number of complaints from patients, either because their sopaclone's been stopped or because they were started it without being told it could be addictive. And it's interesting to read, you know, what we are taught in terms of how long this drug should be prescribed for as a maximum, and what New Zealand formulary says don't prescribe it for longer than 30 days and this sort of thing, versus what is common practice. Based on BPAC's analysis of scripts. So for me, it's, you know, I can say, well, prescribing it, you know, nonstop for a year is certainly not best practice, but it is not uncommon practice, which, you know, gives a bit of leeway in terms of how you quantify somebody not strictly following prescribing directions. So, but always an issue. Always an issue. So on the prescribing theme, so BPAC bulletin at the end of last year looked at a recent study from JAMA Neurology about topiramate and pregnancy, and it's identified that the neurodevelopmental risks to the fetus are at least equal to and possibly exceed sodium valproate. And the same level of caution should therefore be applied when prescribing it to women of childbearing age. So that includes the woman being aware of the risks. Two forms of effective contraception should be used by women of childbearing age. Being careful about any interactions with hormonal contraceptives. And ultimately, it's always whether you actually continue prescribing it at all in women of childbearing age, you need to consider the indication for which it's being taken, whether it's, you know, restless legs versus seizure disorder or mood stabilizer, etc., and just balancing up the risks of stopping the medication and the risks that could have to a pregnancy versus the risks of continuing the medication. But most importantly, I think it's ensuring that the patient's informed of the risks and that they're taking adequate contraception if they're at risk of pregnancy. Because I think it is being used, certainly used in migraine prophylaxis, I think, and I've seen that increasingly used in migraine prophylaxis. So we're certainly going to have women of childbearing age who are migraine sufferers who may well be on it.
Okay, that's
Could
a
be,
one to remember.
it could be a if, you know, a topic for an audit, a relatively easy audit to check females with childbearing age who are on it, and then checking that they are on are taking contraceptive measures.
Yeah, both that and sodium valproate. You've
Right, yeah,
not
and I mean,
opinion about
ACC had a
that.
big push with valproate, so it looks as though we should be pushing that, or they and us should be equally aware of the topiramate issue. Yeah. Drugs still, just ramipril has been available from last month, ACE inhibitor, essentially, I think, aiming to replace selazoprol, which is being phased out. So 1st of December 2022, it was available without restrictions, similar indications to the other ACEs. And there are four dose strengths, 1.25, 2.5, 5, and 10 milligram capsules, and dosing information's readily available on New Zealand formulary and patient information leaflet, also on NZF.
Yeah. We've still got people who are getting repeat prescriptions of Accuretic. Just blows me away. You know, the it's got a contaminated with a carcinogen.
That's right.
And I struggle to understand why people are just picking up repeat doses of it.
Well, I'm prescribed, it's still being dispensed.
Yes, yeah. As well, so that's, really. That's the next step, is to just stop it being dispensed. But
I mean, they obviously haven't been transferred onto something else, which is of some concern as well, given the amount of time and publicity there's been about.
And funding transition as well. And funding. We've actually been funded to make that shift. So, yeah, we need, really, we're just in the process of trying to encourage people to pull finger and get on and stop prescribing Accuretic, please. Use that. And ramipril's another tool in the toolbox.
Yep, certainly something readily available now. Next is just perhaps a bit local, but the cellulitis pathway on health pathways for Midlands has finally been updated to reflect the move away from IV therapy
to Fatuora to Manawa Taki. To Fatuora to Manawa Taki.
Yep, I'll have to start Midlands region. Putting that into my brain.
So this is a shift from IV to oral.
That's right, for most cases. So the pathway is straightforward. I'll bring that up in a moment. But it does still emphasize some points that are useful to remember in terms of general management of cellulitis, the first being checking for signs of sepsis. And again, I just don't see it done that often in cases that I've reviewed where there have been poor outcomes, you know, blood pressure, pulse, temperature not necessarily checked in someone that's presenting with significant cellulitis. And on the handout, I put just a link to the sepsis.org resources again, which I've pushed many times before, but which are quite handy. Wound swabs not usually necessary.
Not just a normal part of our, you know, everybody has a blood pressure, pulse, temperature recorded.
I think in those practices where there is nursing triage, it's probably done more often than I see in other practices. And I'm not sure whether it's a time thing.
You stick the pulse oximeter on somebody, and whilst you're sort of introducing yourself, you check the blood pressure.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just a nice way of holding the patient and having physical contact with the patient, which kind of establishes that.
Yeah, without
that,
being
that bond for the without being complained about. But yeah, useful. And I mean, I always tell the story of the lady that drove herself in just to pick up a repeat script for a urinary tract infection she had. So she'd come to the front counter. She'd been given trimethoprim, I think, and the result had come back as resistant to trimethoprim.
Although other antibiotics are now available.
So I was prescribing some nitrofurantoin for her, and I was just going to hand the script out to reception, and I thought I might as well give it to her. So I called her, and she came in, and she said, "I'm a bit wobbly." So I took a blood pressure, which was, I think, 90 over 40, pulse of 110, AF, temperature of like 38.6 or something, and sent to the hospital, and she ended up in ITU. Oh, so that could have been, it could have been just a disaster waiting to happen. So checking for signs of sepsis, wound swabs are not usually necessary, and if you are taking a sample, don't just swab the skin, wound ooze, or wound surfaces. They say send only aspirate or swab of pus from a drain or draining abscess for microbiology if you are going to swab the wound, and that chronic wounds swabs are a waste of time, essentially.
Right.
And then the pathway gives specific advice whether you're on your penicillin allergy status. I won't get through all the details, but Fluclox is still first line, oral Fluclox, first line for patients with no penicillin allergy. But 1,000 milligrams twice a day with 500 milligrams of probenecid twice a day. So much easier than your 500 QID, which we've used previously. And there are other options here as well, depending on the cause of the wound and status of the wound. And then similar choices, details on the pathway for mild penicillin allergy or severe penicillin allergy. So yeah, very, I mean, again, very useful, as I find the health pathways are generally very useful information.
What's the difference between mild penicillin allergy and severe penicillin allergy?
Yeah, I mean, presumably severe, they're looking at anaphylaxis, and mild it might be, oh, I think I had a rash when I was a kid, that type of thing. Although, again, I'd be a little cautious. You know, if anyone that says they're allergic to penicillin, I treat it as though it might be severe, even if it's only I can't remember, only 10% of people who say they have a penicillin allergy actually do have one.
Yeah. Does that blood test work? There's a blood test for penicillin allergy.
I'm not aware of anything that's foolproof.
Okay.
What do they look at? I can't remember. Yeah, there is something IgE related, I think. But
just write penicillin allergy test, please. On the phone.
They might get something under their skin.
But
in terms of whether you need to change treatment, is treatment being effective? The pathway just reiterates that the natural history of cellulitis is for increasing redness and swelling within the first 48 hours. So it doesn't necessarily mean the antibiotic's not working. And if their patient's improving overall at 48 to 72 hours after oral therapy, don't start intravenous therapy solely due to the persistence of redness or swelling. But if you're concerned about the patient's ability to adhere to the regime or absorption, IV therapy is still a fallback for patients with moderate cellulitis. Mm. So that's the reminder there. Prescribing, again, number five is just Pharmax removed funding restrictions for, or will be for, zoledronic acid, Aclestra infusions from the 1st of March.
Okay.
So there'll no longer be a requirement for DEXA scan results. And again, just with that increased access, a reminder that there are certain things you need to do when you're considering a zoledronic acid infusion, particularly around checking the patient's renal function and ensuring hydration to make sure it's suitable for the patient. And Health Pathways, again, has a very helpful section on zoledronic acid infusion, which includes a checklist to make sure you've covered all the things that should be covered prior to administering the drug.
Is that, and obviously that'll change when they remove the restrictions.
Yeah, I think the only thing that should change will be, do they fulfill the criteria? But the actual practical things like checking whether they've had loading dose of vitamin D, fluid intake, make sure their EGFR or creatinine clearance is within the acceptable range, etc.
We'll have to revise why or when zoledronic acid is required then, when it actually provides benefit, because the worry is that people will be given it at, you know, much lower levels of osteoporosis when it potentially isn't giving a lot of benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that BPAC will come out with some refresher in that regard. As we get closer to the date that this is introduced,
there'll be evidence around, won't there, around what's when it becomes valuable or not. But I need to revise that.
And again, it could even be part of if the Health Pathways is updated, including in that area as well. Almost at the end, the Health Quality and Safety Commission have developed a guide to support aged residential care multidisciplinary teams in managing UTI in aged care facilities, or optimizing UTI diagnosis and care in aged care facilities. So I think the concern is at the moment that there's probably over-treatment and inappropriate treatment of UTIs in aged care at the moment. And a lot of that is related to not good systems for empowering nursing staff to either recognise UTI or suspect UTI or test for UTI. And it gives quite a handy flow chart that you could use with your aged care facility staff if you're visiting aged care facility GP or nurse practitioner. Certainly puts dipstick urinalysis in its place solely as a rule out for UTI, not as a diagnosis of UTI. So a negative dipstick is of significance, a positive dipstick is not, from a diagnostic point of view. That's what they emphasize. But again, just a handy resource, handy chart that can be used by the nursing staff at the aged care facility
So
to.
do they recommend then sending for a culture with a dipstick positive test?
No. I mean, what the flow chart does is it gives you quite strict clinical criteria. So this is partly about empowerment of nursing staff to ring the prescriber and say, this is I followed this side of the pathway. Yes, the criteria are met, which means yes, an MSU does need to be sent off and antibiotics can be started empirically while waiting for the result. Whereas if the dipstick is positive, say, but there are no, well, first of all, you're not going to be doing the dipstick unless the clinical criteria are met or there is some suspicion of non-specific deterioration in health. So two sides to the pathway. If the clinical criteria are met for UTI, then it can be as straightforward as the nursing staff just requesting an antibiotic. If the clinical criteria aren't met, there are other criteria that could raise suspicion, in which case there's discussion with the GP about the next move rather than immediately assuming it's a UTI.
So, I mean, as you know, the laboratories are not doing urine cultures unless there's a very good reason explained on the form. Particularly, you know, if you've got a positive dipstick, then they just say, well, assume it's a UTI and treat accordingly.
And certainly for I think there's increasing evidence of not necessarily in the aged care group, but in the sort of just adult, young adult and middle adult group, that if they think they've got a UTI, there's a high likelihood that they have. I
And
concluded a
that
study recently.
and I suppose what that's saying is as you say, if you haven't got the clinical symptoms and you've got a positive dipstick, then you know that's not particularly highly sensitive, or you're not preempting a UTI that's developing by treating at that stage.
That's right. Yeah. And I think in the aged care sector, if you've got a patient who's unwell with a fever, then the almost the reflex action in the absence of any urinary symptoms, the reflex action still seems to be we'll dipstick the urine, and if it's positive, it's got to be a UTI when you might miss a pneumonia that's the actual real cause in that situation.
Absolutely.
Summertime. Spring and summer is Legionella season.
My mum had Legionella.
Is she a potter? I'm not a gardener.
No, but she lived in a very close community, like lots of houses one on top of the other over in the UK. And they thought it was an air conditioning unit from somewhere that was pumping out the stuff.
So that would be Legionella longbeachii. Sorry, no, it would be Legionella pneumophila, which is associated with water systems, whereas longbeachii is this one associated with compost and potting mix. But the reason why it flares up this time of the year is usually increased exposure to compost and potting mix as part of gardening activities. And there were 34 cases in the 3 weeks to 29th of November 2022, which is almost double the same period in 2021. 4 cases in the Waikato in November.
Good excuse not to do any gardening this week.
Yeah, or just wear a mask when you slash open the sacks of potting mix.
Hopefully my wife isn't listening to this, Dave. Yeah.
But the symptoms are less helpful than risk factors in assessing the risk for Legionella. So it is important, I think, in someone with a chronic cough or even signs of community-acquired pneumonia, just to check whether they've had exposure to potting mix or compost in recent times. Yeah. But the more common symptoms with Legionella are dry cough, high fever and chills, shortness of breath. I mean, I'm just describing community-acquired pneumonia, really. Yeah. But quite often abdominal pain and diarrhea is more common than with other forms of community-acquired pneumonia. And in terms of diagnosis, sputum for PCR and culture, noting risk factors on the request form. Mm. If you're highly suspicious it's a water system-related infection, then a urine antigen test is positive for Legionella pneumophila, but doesn't pick up Legionella long beachii for some reason.
So with the sputum?
The sputum does for both.
Both, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And treatment is just adding in roxithromycin, 300 milligrams daily for 10 to 14 days to standard community-acquired pneumonia treatment.
So, and it, adding in the roxithromycin?
Adding in the roxithromycin. If you've got a culture-proven or PCR-proven Legionella, then you could go to monotherapy. But while you're waiting for the result, you need to really cover community-acquired bugs as well as adding in the possibility of Legionnaires. Hmm. And that's it for the... for the kind of education. Just a reminder, this afternoon there's a cyber incident response planning hui.
Nationally?
Te Whatu Ora, Health New Zealand's hosting it. 12 to 1 p.m. I'm not sure if it's too late to register. There's an email address, a person you can email if you want to attend, who I presume would give you the access details. But just a reminder, I guess, that this response hui is being held because there are an increasing number of cyber incidents, and to ensure your system is as protected as possible.
Yeah, and health systems, even down to GPs, are amongst the highest reported cyber incidents internationally. So it's something that we need to take very seriously right the way down to the individual practice level, and to put high on the agenda for your board meetings, to make sure that this is something that you're thinking about all of the time and keeping regularly up to date on, I think.
Another stress,
but you know, that's what life is about. Where would we be without stress, Dave?
Stress and uncertainty, it's the basis of medicine, really, isn't it?
The experts in uncertainty, absolutely. Hey, thanks, Dave. That's really brilliant. So we covered sleep, topiramate in pregnancy, the ramipril, and the changes from IV to oral therapy for cellulitis, zoledronic acid, and the relaxation of special authorities. Talk quite a bit about UTIs again. You know, these are common bread and butter stuff, but something that we, and that algorithm looks really interesting and to learn more about. And Legionella, this time of the year, particularly with exposure to potting mix. But if you don't think about it, you won't pick it up. Which is a little bit like the cyber incident stuff as well, that you know, we've got to be thinking about it in advance so that we can prevent significant harm, not just to our patients but also to ourselves. It's far less stressful dealing with it and preventing it than it is dealing with it once it's happened, from personal experience.
Deadly.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you again next month.
See you in February.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.